This is continuing with John Finley on 18 August 1981 at Ursi in Washington. Well, two topics that we missed a couple days ago. The first was your horn antenna that you built at Green Bay. Could you tell me what was the motivation for it and how you built it and what results came out of it in the early years?
Yes, at that time there was really not very good knowledge of the spectra of many radio sources, and so it was necessary to measure in absolute terms the flux of a few sources at quite a number of frequencies. And it was Fred Haddock who said to me, why don't you measure Cass A and measure it with a horn antenna, a standard gain horn.
Mm-hmm.
And so I built the horn. I actually started by planning to build it pointing south, which was silly. It should point north. I found the slope, the right value, 30 degrees, built the horn on it. And from that time on, I have regularly measured the flux of Cass A. Whether the results are of any great value, I've only done it at two frequencies, 1400 and 810 megahertz.
This horn is roughly how large?
About 125 feet long, and my recollection is the end dimensions, the big end is 17.5 feet by about 12 feet.
Right. And in those first three or four years, did you make regular measurements?
Fairly regular. As a matter of fact, it turns out it's a transit telescope, of course. It's just pointing up the slope in such an azimuth that the SA goes through the beam. And yeah, I generally have always made nighttime measurements, and that conveniently is summer. The transit is midnight,
right.
Just about at the middle of the summer, which is a nice time to observe at Greenback.
Right. Now, did you have any idea in your mind about possibly it varying with time, a long-term variation?
No, we've just checked back on that, and when I built it, I think you're right in saying the variability had not been found, and of course that's not a very serious disadvantage to the source. The disadvantages are that it's too large a diameter really to be used for present day telescopes, but it has in fact been that spectrum has been the transfer spectrum generally.
Right. Even today.
Yes, yeah. And is still used a very great deal in by the practical people, you know, by the people doing ground based satellite
antenna gain calibration,
yes,
sort of things, yeah. Right. Now, when Herb Bowman Shakeshaft said, we think we've got evidence of Cass A varying, did you go back to your two or three years by that time?
Yes,
data? Could you see it?
In fact, the first paper I published did show a variation. Of course, it's a clumsy and difficult way to see a variation when you're measuring in absolute terms.
Yes.
The easy way there is what they did is to look for
ratio with
Cygnus.
Yeah.
And we had such an experiment also at Green Bank. Heeshan ran a simple transit telescope source comparison, which showed the variation too.
I see. After the discovery, he was motivated to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the other subject that we didn't talk about was the 1959 WARC conference, and even more specifically, the attitude of the radio astronomy community towards interference and protection from it. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're saying?
Yes, I'd like to do that, and I'll go all the way back and say, as I just said to you, before, it was as early as 1950 and maybe even before, there were movements in ERSI to develop the desire, you know, for protection of radio frequency bands, and in some way those never came to anything, and so it was not, I think, until the fact that Sputnik went up that really alerted people to the fact that radio astronomy was really at risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when things fly around the sky, it's at risk.
Yeah.
And so,
in fact, you said that ERSI actually, at some early stage, around 1950 perhaps, refused to, or that they made a resolution and withdrew it at a later conference?
Yeah, I think if you'd like that, I will look it up and try and remember to send you a note as to what happened, because my memory is no good now, is exactly who did what.
But they were hardly strongly in favor, in any case, of
no, they
protection.
Were not. They were not. And the thing came to a head again in preparation for the 1959 walk, when it was pretty clear that internationally we didn't have a good strong position.
Mm-hmm.
And I was appointed at the ERSI 1957 meeting in Boulder to lead a subcommission, an international group, to get this a good strong position for radio astronomers written into the CCIR papers so that it would get to walk that way,
mm-hmm.
but also generated in some countries so that this radio astronomy position would be put on the table by some countries. Make a long story short, I did do that. I talked with a science advisor in Washington, Kistiakowski,
Well, that was a good story.
Yeah, that was an amusing one, because it so happened I didn't realize old Otto Struve knew him. And so Otto and
they were both Russian immigrants.
They were both Russian immigrants, white Russians. I think cavalry officers. And
really?
And Otto and I went to call on Tistikovsky. You didn't realize until I read Tisti's book that he had only just been sworn in that morning. We were his first official visitors. And I'm in his book as John W. Finney of the New York Times, but Otto is there all right. And the conversation is correctly recorded. He said, I explained the position, he said, you've got to go international. You've got to go and drum up. The position being, you see, that the United States had made a position on radio astronomy which was not good enough.
Yes.
And so Tisti quite rightly said, go and see Wallace Brode in the State Department and see what whether he can help you.
It's got to be a broader base to support
that's right.
to have any
and
chance.
He said, go international. Yeah. But Wallace Brode was a... You can bleep that bit. So I did. And Ort, of course, was the man who helped. Lyell didn't help much. Lovell helped. Ort was a great help. When I went to see Ort, he just said, well, it's quite easy. We had already developed a CCIR position for the hydrogen line, the only line we knew at that time, and these octave bands all the way through the spectrum with adequate bandwidth. When I explained this to Jan Ort, he just said, easy. He said, that will be the Netherlands position at the conference, and so it was.
Now, were there any international allocations for radio astronomy before the 59 war?
No, none at all. And in fact, we didn't win as much as we should have done in that war.
But some individual countries, I suppose, had some, probably in Holland or
no, there was no. We were just doing that thing, you see.
I see.
What the ionospheric physicist, what I did in ionospheric research, merely turn on a transmitter. You don't tell anybody. And the radio astronomers merely turned on their receivers. They're not worried.
Yeah, but there were regulations. You were supposed to report transmitters, weren't you?
Not ionospheric transmitters, not still, I think.
Really?
They're not sending intelligence. There's something like that in it. The sweet frequency transmitters, how are you doing?
Oh, we've got about 5 minutes.
Yes. Let me do this little one about the walk itself.
But I'd like to ask about the general situation of interference in radio astronomy observations. You didn't do that many yourself in the 50s, but you're probably cognizant of what the situation... I mean, was it a problem?
No. The problems I recollect from Lyell's group were the fluorescent lamps in the neighboring buildings, and of course the automobile traffic that he was up the road. No, those frequency bands were...
The spectrum was open.
What did he start on? 81 megahertz?
Was his lowest? Roughly, in 160.
And then 160 and on up. Except for the well-known military radars. The old 200 megahertz radars were there. Mm-hmm. There wasn't much.
Right, so it was really looking to the future then.
Yes, As I say, I think it was the Sputnik threat, the satellite threat that woke everybody up.
Mm-hmm. So what were you going to say?
The conference itself was, from the United States point of view, almost either a tragedy or a joke. Ort came in, the Netherlands came in, and the United States was opposing the Netherlands and astronomy, and it wasn't Sullivan, it was the other one, Laura, the New York Times man, and he ran the headline, I've got the headline. Mm-hmm. United States opposed to radio astronomy and science in Geneva, and that brought the house down. Actually, 5 members of the delegation were flown back from Geneva to meet with us in the National Academy to redo the American position halfway through. You can imagine how popular we were.
Right.
It was a shocking piece of work on Apple.
So you mean that one New York Times article really swung it?
Yes. Yeah. Well, people triggered that. Struve triggered that, and so did Leo Goldberg.
Well, it didn't happen accidentally. The article didn't happen accidentally.
It didn't happen accidentally at all. I mean, they were okay. But we got a pretty good position for the United States at the end of the conference. And then subsequent conferences, we won a lot at smaller conferences which were devoted to space. And that we joined on with space. Space and radio astronomy were considered twice at conferences whose dates I've forgotten before this latest 1979 walk.
Right, in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
What was the U.S. wanting to do with, for instance, the 1420 megahertz band? I mean, do you happen to remember military
No, they were prepared to clear that. This what we have now, 1400 to 1427, that was in the United States position for radio astronomy. It was the only thing
there
was. And the rest was local arrangements.
I see.
And, of course, we didn't have OH at that time.
Right.
and that came up in time to be...
There were no other lines that were proposed by the radio astronomers.
No. Did we write down deuterium on a prediction? I believe we might have done, but nobody took any notice.
There had been a couple papers, my Towns was one, talking about the OH lines, but of course their frequencies weren't that accurately known.
That's right, yes.
That's another point.
And we all felt that we're not going to argue for anything until we did
it. Yeah, it was unlikely they were going to be important on anybody's guess.
Okay, that's it, I think.
Thank you very much.
Very good.
And that ends a little disjointed part of the interview with John Finley on 18 August 81. First parts of the interview are on tapes 148, 151, 152. And this is the end of the tape. No need to listen any further.